Thank you very much. I'm glad to be able to give now my second Aaron Bowman Memorial Lecture. I will state again that I certainly regret that I never had a chance to meet him. I hear more about him with each passing year, every time there is something in his memory, or that poetry reading, whatever it is. And the more I hear about him, the more I wish I had. So I'm very glad to be able to do this in his memory. The title of the talk is advertised is A Different Night Indeed, Laws and Customs of the Seder You Never Heard Of. So first, I just want to give a disclaimer that you're not getting your money back if, in fact, you've heard of any of the things that I'm going to be speaking about today. But I hope to bring in some new and interesting things that are not usually discussed, whether they're actually practiced nowadays, whether it's recommended to be practiced nowadays or not. Still interesting things that have happened historically, different opinions about what should be done at the Seder. And again, I will try to make a point of distinguishing what is halacha l'maisa, what's not halacha l'maisa, what's not actually practical. And of course, I welcome any questions or comments at any time. The first thing I want to discuss, something about the Seder that's not an actual stage in the Seder, but is very commonly misunderstood, and that is the Ke'ara, the Seder plate. So the Seder plate, if you go into a Judaica store, you will find a little plate, about this big, with six different places on it for things to be, ritual foods to be placed on it at the Seder. So the way most people think about the Seder plate, and the way most Judaica companies apparently think about the Seder plate, is that it's a nice ceremonial thing that is for display. For display, it's to be able to think about these things during the Seder. But in fact, it's not true at all. In the times of the Gemara, the way people used to eat meals, as that we all know, think about the couches all the time, because that has to do with Haseba and the reclining on Seder night that I were more familiar with. But there's also another big change that happened from the reclining on couches during formal meals to the to sitting in chairs like we do today, which is that everybody used to have their own little table, and that's what they used to eat off of. They didn't have plates or charger plates or placemats or whatever around one big table. Rather, everybody had their own small table. So the foods used to be, the foods for the Seder used to be brought out on the little table, right? So nowadays we have a big table and we don't have a little table, so the food has to be there already. So we want something that's movable. You want something that you can take, you can bring out, and you can bring back to the kitchen if need be. And we'll discuss a little bit more later that part of the ritual of the Seder, at least in the times of the Gemara, was the taking out of the shulchan, of the little table, the bringing it back at certain points. So therefore, we have a large plate, instead of like we do on Shabbos, for example. On Shabbos, we also have a concept, as we discussed in our shiur between Mincha and Ma'ariv on Shabbos afternoon, of covering the challahs. So what does it mean? Why do we cover the challahs? So the Gemara tells us in Pesachim, in the beginning of the last parak, the 10th parak, that ein mevi'in es hashulchan elim kein kiddush. You're not allowed to bring the table before kiddush. So what did that mean, of course? Nowadays, like, bring the table. Table's always there. What do you mean, bring the table? So, of course, what it means is in the times of the Gemara, the way it used to work is that they only brought out the little table with all the food on it for the participants after kiddush was made. And as the Shiltes famously explains, that was done in order to make clear that we're now dining in honor of Shabbos. So the table is set on Erev Shabbos, and you just sat down to eat, and you made kiddush after the table was there already, so it looks like, okay, the food's there already, okay, now we're going to have our Shabbos meal. No, you want to make clear that the food's being brought in honor of Shabbos, so therefore you bring out the food only after you make kiddush. So all the Rishonim discuss how, since we don't have little tables nowadays, we only have big tables. So what we do is you have a challah cover. This is one of the reasons for the challah cover. We brought other reasons. One of the reasons for the challah cover is the challah is covered, and then when you uncover the challah, it's as if you're bringing out the food right then and there. So that's why the challah, according to most shittas, as opposed to the Vilna Gaon, which is discussed then, should be placed on the table before kiddush and should be covered at that time. Then you bring it out, then when you uncover it, it's as if you brought the food at that time. And that's, in fact, this Eitzah is really given in the Gemara too, that it says that if accidentally you did bring out the food before Kiddush, you don't have to take away the whole table, you don't have to, you know, give your servants extra work. Because everybody, of course, had a full-time wait staff. But you have to, you don't give your servants extra work, you just cover the table. Then you uncover the table after Kiddush, it gives the same effect. So we've implemented that basically as a lechatchila, as an at the outset thing we do, instead of the way it's presented the Gemara, which is a bidyebet. So in theory, what you could do, since the big table is instead of the little table, in theory, what you could do is you should just have all the food for the Seder laid out on the table in front of the Baal HaBayis. But since you don't want to do that because you might want to remove the food at some point, so therefore you have a Seder plate. And that takes the place of the little table that was in the times of the Gemara. There's a series of very fat svarim about every topic you could possibly imagine called Nitte Gavriel, which is by a Hungarian Rav. He lives in Borough Park, Rabbi Gavriel Tzinner. And he writes, most of the halacha svarim, the short halacha svarim that they have nowadays, are about regular topics. They give the basic shittas of the Achronim, the Shulchan Aruch, the Mishneh Berurah, in a more digestible fashion. The Nitte Gavriel writes about every single topic you could imagine under the sun. He has a whole sefer on Upsharon. He has a whole sefer on Hachnosa Sefer Torah. However, most of these things are a footnote in another book. They don't have their own books to them. So he brings everybody's customs, everything that they do. So he writes, he has a whole chapter on the Seder plate. He says, first of all, one thing that I'm basically trying to make sure that you don't think like this, is that he says that some Hasidic groups apparently, have the custom that the Seder plate is holy. We don't touch the food on the Seder plate, it's for display only. And that's the way some people, I think, even in our communities think about it, that you have karpas on the Seder plate, for example, but you also have big things of karpas that you pass around to everyone. And that's, but you leave the karpas on the Seder plate there for the whole Seder. That's not true. The whole point of the Seder plate, the kaira, is to have the food that you're going to eat at the Seder. So certainly, you know, there's no problem whatsoever in having the karpas, taking the karpas from the Seder plate and not having any more karpas on the Seder plate after karpas is done. There's no problem that whatsoever. It's made to be used. It's not meant for decoration only. So again, in that Sefer Nitte Gavriel, he has a whole appendix in the back. He says, see, in the chapter on the Seder plate, it says, see the diagrams in the back. So if you look in the back of the Sefer, he has diagrams of, it must have been 30 or more different minhagim of how to set up the Seder plate, different orders of the foods. He says some Hasidic groups are makbid to specifically use the Seder plate with legs, so and put the matzah underneath and the Seder plate on top, and some have a Seder plate, some don't put a napkin between the matzahs, they have the matzahs at dafka touching each other, some yes, any different permutations you can imagine. There's no, all these things are not at the level of minag. You can do whatever you want. It's so this is one of the things in Judaism where there is free choice. You can do whatever you, however you please, whatever kind of Seder plate you want. That just because your father had a certain kind of Seder plate, that doesn't have the status of a minag, that you have to have this exact kind of Seder plate, and you can't do it any other way. He says that some groups, they are makbid to put the foods directly on the Seder plate without having little bowls for each one individually. Some groups, no, they specifically have bowls for each one individually. All these things really, alpidin, halachically, don't matter in the slightest. You can do it however you want. But again, really what should be done, in theory, although most Seder plates that are made nowadays aren't this big, is to have a Seder plate that where you have enough food for everyone to partake from the food on the Seder plate. So if you have karpas, so you have, I don't know, how much is enough for everyone? 5 stalks of celery, I don't know, how many people are in your Seder. So that, again, you're allowed to supplement it. Not everything has to be on the Seder plate, although that would be the ideal. But in theory, the best would be to have a Seder plate with all the food that's going to be needed and eaten on the Seder plate on it already. There are different opinions about how to arrange the foods on the Seder plate. The Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch gives a very simple way to arrange the foods on the Seder plate. He says that you go based on the principle of Ein mavirin al ha-mitzvahs. That you're not supposed to pass over a mitzvah. That's like in your talis bag in the morning. You're supposed to arrange it in a way that you get to your talis before your tefillin, so you don't have to go over the tefillin to get to the talis. Simple enough. So this Ramah says, very simple. First you put the karpas, then the salt water, and then you put the, what comes next? The matzah, then the maror, then whatever, in whatever order it happens to be in, so you don't pass over the mitzvahs. And that presumably was the Ashkenazi minag for a very long time. The way we have the Seder plate arranged nowadays, that you're not going to find any Seder plate in the world that's commercially manufactured that has it a different way, is the order of the Arizal, with these, which Kabbalistic things that has to be arranged in this way of like two triangles together, like a Jewish star, although I don't think it's related, but it's arranged in a certain way that you have, for various Kabbalistic reasons, you have these things in this order. One thing I can never figure out about the Arizal's method of making the Seder plate is why there are two types of maror. Apparently, according to his understanding of Kabbalah, you need to have one type of maror for the eating of the maror, and the other one for the sandwich of the korech, which according to the basic halacha is not necessary at all. You just use one thing of maror. So most people put one is romaine lettuce and one is horseradish. Okay. That's if you want to do it that way, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But again, everybody knows my sheet about horseradish, that it's a garnish for the fish and not maror. But any event, if you want to have it on the Seder plate, then there's nothing wrong. But certainly according to the basic halacha, there's no reason to have two different types of maror on the Seder plate. One is perfectly fine. One of the things that's maror on the Seder plate is the charosis, which is, everybody knows how to make charosis. You all have a recipe from your grandparents, and you follow that recipe. So it's always very strange to me, because in regular Ashkenazi charosis, I mean, I've heard about Sephardi charosis, I don't know if I've ever actually seen it. Maybe it's packaged in a store somewhere. I think I might have seen it once. But in any event, most people cut the fruits from which the charosis is made into little chunks, right? So the charosis ends up being little chunks. So I never, the way the Rishonim describe it, when they talk about, I'm certainly like, the Rambam is not using the same thing that we Ashkenazim are using. He says you use the dates and figs. The reason is because that in Shir HaShirim, it talks about Klal Yisrael being, Nimshal, being compared to certain types of fruits. You should try to use that in the Charoses. Whatever it is, you use all these dried fruits and you beat them into a paste in order to resemble mortar. Has anyone ever seen mortar? It's a paste. Doesn't have little chunks in it like that. So that's why I don't quite understand exactly the way we make charosis nowadays into little chunks. So the first year I was married, so I was in charge of making the charosis, and I put in the food processor. So I made it into a paste. I used the regular Ashkenazi ingredients, but I made it into a paste. And my wife and mother-in-law come home, because they were working here at Pesach, and I was at my mother-in-law's house that year. I said, "What's this?" Charosis. No, it's not. It's not charosis, but what's charosis? I made it look like a paste, because it's supposed to look like a mortar, resemble the mortar that the Jewish people used in Egypt to build all the things that they were building, not the pyramids, but the other buildings that they did in fact build. The Gemara says about the charosis, tzarech l'samuchei v'tzarech l'kahuyei. That I'm not even going to translate it, because there are a gazillion different explanations about exactly what this means. According to one explanation, what it means is you have to make it thick, l'samuche, but tzarech l'kahuye means that it has to be thick, like mortar, and it has to be sharp. You have to put something in it that's a little bit sharp, like lemon juice or vinegar or something like that, with an acidic type of taste. I know Rav Schechter always says over that you should put in lemon juice or something of this nature, because the Jewish people were compared to a tapuach. That's what it says in Shir HaShirim. So tapuach, he thinks, really doesn't mean apple, it really means citrus fruit, because they didn't really have apples in the Middle East at the time. So I don't know if that's entirely clear, but putting in a little lemon juice or something like that into the charosis or vinegar certainly doesn't hurt, and it's at least the kiyum of this idea, v'tzarech l'kahuye. Another explanation that's given in the Yerushalmi means, first you make it thick, then you make it thin. So what does it mean, first you make it thick and then you make it thin? So the Yerushalmi says, so the first, because the it has first it has to resemble the mortar, and then later on it has to resemble blood. Alright, so what you do basically is you start by making it like a thick paste, and then when you get to the actual dipping of the maror into the charoses, because the thing is a paste, it's not really a dip, so you add a lot of wine at that time, and you make the charoses into much thinner than it used to be. And this is also something that not that many people actually do, but it is mentioned explicitly in the Yerushalmi, to in fact dilute the charoses with wine right before you're about to use it. One thing that's also somewhat ignored on Pesach is normally we're not supposed to display wealth. So even if you have very nice vessels, so don't go overboard normally to set the table. And also there's a halacha of zecher lamikdash, that when you set a very grand table, you're not supposed to put every single last thing in detail into what you're supposed to, and how one would normally set the table. You're supposed to leave something out in order to remember the Beis HaMikdash. But on Seder night, basically none of this actually applies. That you're supposed to bring it all out, bring out all the fanciest stuff that you actually own and put it on the Seder table. That's why, I guess, silver stores, they have, well, if you go into a silver store, they have a lot of fancy silver Seder plates because, I mean, they have a lot of fancy silver everything. But one of the most popular items is a Seder plate because that's taka one of the times where there's no problem in being extra super fancy. It says that the Maharil used to bring out all the vessels that he apparently used to lend money to non-Jews. So when they would give him a collateral, they would give him a mashkon of very, very fancy vessels, and he would bring them out specifically on Seder night to decorate the table. So nowadays, what are we doing for the Seder? We don't have the energy for this. We're using paper plates. We're using the cheapest stainless steel cutlery that we could rustle up. So that's not necessarily the most correct action. I'm not criticizing. I probably will be using paper plates myself, trying to get nice paper plates. But there is something to be said, even though you think, oh, it's just 1 week a year. Why do I need to save my actual silver for Pesach? So the answer is because that's the one time of year where actually it's supposed to be the fanciest type of vessels, because now we went from being enslaved to being free, so free people can afford fancier things. There is a halacha that those of us, one we don't like so much, which is that the Seder is not supposed to start before nightfall, before the official halachic Tzeis HaKochavim. However, I should be aware that someone was telling me they're going to conduct the Seder this year in the nursing home. They have very elderly parents. That this idea that you're not supposed to start the Seder before nightfall, that's the halacha. There's no question whatsoever. For regular people, should not at all be lenient on this. They should not even begin to say Kiddush. Maybe. Okay. We gave a shir on that last Pesach, I believe, starting the Seder early. But it's not 100% clear in all the Rishonim that they actually don't allow starting the Seder at all early. There are shitas that allow, certainly some of the Haggadah has to be said, the main parts of the Haggadah have to be said after absolute halachic nightfall. So only the matzah has to be eaten after absolute halachic nightfall. There's nothing to discuss. But in an emergency situation, there is room to recite. I mean, if you do it after sunset, even if it's not after Tzeis HaKochavim, that's even better. But let's say you have, like, again, and for emergency situations only, if you have a very elderly relative that you need, for whom you need to make the Seder, or, again, something of that nature, so there is room to at least begin before nightfall and continue afterwards. Of course, the best thing is, if you can get them to agree to this, although I don't know if they're people are going to agree, because everybody knows that with Simani HaSeder, Kaddish comes first, Halel Nirtza comes at the end. So you have to follow, it's the Seder after all. It means order, so you have to follow the order. So obviously the best thing in such a situation would be, start with Chag Gadya. Chag Gadya has no halachic significance. So start with Chag Gadya, try to buy time as much as possible. So you start with the Kiddush as late as possible, hopefully making it till after Tzeis HaKochavim, absolute halachic nightfall. Speaking of the Simani HaSeder, the order in which the Seder comes, so we have this cute poem at the beginning of the Seder, which lists all the activities that we're going to do that night. And most people misunderstand what this poem actually says, because it starts with verbs, right? Kaddish, make Kiddush. It's the P-A-L Tzivui, as our Hebrew teacher could tell us. And urchatz, and then wash your hands. That's our commands. Those are tzivui. Those are verbs. They're not nouns. But since we've divided up the poem, and now we describe each part of the Seder with this word, so we can think of it in our heads as nouns, but it's not actually true. The same thing as magid, whatever. Magid is not a noun. That means now you tell the story. It's a participle, telling the story. Whereas we think of Magid as the name of the telling of the story of the Haggadah in the middle of the Seder. And it's funny, because what is the end of the poem? Halel Nirtza. So how do you translate Halel Nirtza? Most people think of it as one step is Halel, then the last step is Nirtza. So what does Nirtza mean? Conclusion, of course. So I have an acquaintance who wrote his own Haggadah. So he writes in the beginning of his Haggadah, where it says, Nirtza is commonly assumed to mean something like conclusion. I don't know in what language Nirtza means conclusion, but it's not Hebrew. It sure isn't Hebrew. So what it means, of course, is that Halel Nirtza means that at the end, the Halel will be, Nirtza will be found with favor before God. Nirtza is not a separate stage of the Seder. The Seder ends at Halel. The other piyutim afterwards are extra. They're not actually part of the halachic part of the Seder. So really, there is no part of the Seder called Nirtza, but again, in colloquial usage, we call Nirtza the nice poems and songs after the Seder. Some people have the custom, indeed, to say each stage of the Seder, Kadesh, Mekidesh, Urchatz, wash your hands, Karpas, eat the Karpas, and they announce before each thing that they're going to do the name of the, from this poem, what they're going to do. Others don't have this practice. I never liked it. It always rubbed me the wrong way. Nothing wrong with it, halakhically, obviously, of course. But the whole point is that in the beginning, you're supposed to remind yourself what to do, and then it's supposed to flow. It's not like the poem defines very clearly these stages of the Seder, but that's not really what it is. First you do this, then you do this, then you do this. It's all one thing that's supposed to flow. It's not something that really should be divided into different sections. So I never like doing that, but again, if you want to do it, no problem whatsoever. This year Pesach will fall on Shabbos, the first day of Pesach, so there are different minhagim as to whether you say Shalom Aleichem when Pesach falls on Shabbos and all the other stuff. Like if you've been to some houses where they say the whole gigantic thing that's printed in the bencher that most people just quick. They automatically just skip, their eye goes from one page to the page right afterwards. Some people say that, even on Seder nights. Some say it should be said quietly, because you don't really need the malachim there that night, because on Pesach night is so holy that you don't need the malachim, but it's not nice to skip it entirely, because it's not nice to tell the malachim that they're not wanted. So therefore, say it quietly. But as far as I'm aware, the vast majority of people, at least in our community, again, correct me if I'm wrong, do not say Shalom Aleichem or any of these things, or Yeshua Schael or anything, when Seder night or any Yontif falls on Shabbos. One of the things that we said was one of the differences between ancient meals and modern meals is the transition from eating on couches to eating on chairs. So nevertheless, we still have a requirement to act as if we're eating on couches on Seder night, and there's a requirement of heseba, or leaning, reclining, during certain points of the Seder. So this is designed to be a nice thing. It's supposed to be that in free people recline when they're eating. It's not supposed to be a hardship. It's like eating a kezayis matzah means kezayis is the minimum shear. You eat, if you can't eat so much, you eat a tiny amount, then you're yotze the mitzvah b'dieved. It's not a task that you have to complete. That's not really what it's supposed to be at all. A certain amount of time, a huge shear, quickly, let's shove it all in our mouths and swallow it all at once. That's not at all what it's about. It's the minimum. That's the minimum shear. So the same thing too, people think the heseba is a imposition. Who likes eating reclining? That's terrible. I don't want to recline at the Seder. And in fact, that would be in accordance with the famous opinion of the Ravia that nowadays that we don't recline at all. That even in the fanciest Gentile meals, nobody reclines. So it just means you eat in the manner of the fancy people. It goes by the time and place, but that's not the commonly accepted halacha. That the accepted halacha is that you have to lean no matter what, at least as a remembrance to what was done in the old times, so that the children should ask the question. But we should try to make sure that the seba is done, that the reclining is done in a comfortable way. If you have a chair that's not very comfortable, and you sort of turn yourself to the side and force yourself against the chair, again, it's not also you're not supposed to lean in midair. So one thing very important to keep in mind, you're not just supposed to lean over the arm if you're sitting in an armchair. That's not a seba at all. You have to support the side of your body and actually recline on something. So if you don't have a couch, which would be the best, if we could all go back to couches, I'd like that. But if you don't have the room for that, then you make it nice with a pillow and a footstool, if you like, if you have room for that, and try to make it as comfortable as possible and relaxing as possible when you do that seba. Although halakhically speaking, it's not necessarily necessary per se to have a pillow. Although people, you know, they have these nice pillow covers that say kulanu mesubin, as if the pillow is the main part of the seba, which is not. But still, it's a very good idea to try to make it as comfortable so you look forward to doing haseba on Seder night, as opposed to thinking of it as something uncomfortable and annoying, and oive, it's another task. One of those difficult halachos that oive all the sacrifice that we have to make on Seder night, which is certainly not the correct attitude at all. Then we get to the Kiddush. And one thing that's different about this night is that the Ramah says in Shulchan Aruch that even though the minhag throughout the rest of the year is to wash Netilas Yadayim before Kiddush, on Seder night everybody agrees that you wash Netilas Yadayim after Kiddush. So for most people who wash Netilas Yadayim after Kiddush all year round, so this is not such a big deal. But for people who wash Netilas Yadayim before Kiddush, it should not be done on Seder night. There is a minority opinion that even on Seder night you could do it. There is also a minority opinion, the Marshal, I believe, said this way, that you should wash twice. Because normally you don't want to be mevatel, cancel completely the idea of washing before Kiddush. So you wash your hands once before Kiddush, and since you're not going right into the meal, so normally it's not a Kiddush is not a hefsek between washing and the meal because it's necessary for the meal. Since you're not going right into the meal, so you wash again before Karpas. So the Taz, in his commentary in the Shulchan Aruch, rips on that. He says, first of all, I hold that we should wash after Kiddush always all year long. And, okay, whether you accept that or not. But whatever it is, he says that's not, he doesn't agree with the Marshal at all. It doesn't make sense at all to wash twice. One thing I remember when we were learning the Sefer HaChinuch that we found interesting is that the way the Sefer HaChinuch presents the Seder is that right before Kiddush, you wash one hand. Whoever heard of washing one hand? Always until it's a dime is two hands. You wash one hand. That's based on the sheet of the Rashba, who was a teacher of the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, that it's based on a Tosefta that says when you go into the meal and you drink wine before the meal and you're not ready to wash for bread yet, so you wash one hand. The reason being that liquids are more susceptible to tumah, to ritual impurity in halacha, than are solids. So in case the cup is wet or something, so you don't want to touch it with an impure hand, so you wash the hand before you go into the meal. So this, most Rishonim hold that this is not an absolute halacha, either it's just recommendation or it's only in the times when Tumah and Tara are applicable, but the Rashba says, no, this is an absolute halacha, even regular. On Friday night, before whoever's making Kiddush makes Kiddush, you have to wash one hand. So that certainly is not done nowadays at all. We just go straight into the Kiddush without washing before at all. There is a halacha always by Koshel Bracha that you're supposed to wash it out. Any cup that's used for ritual purposes, you're supposed to wash it out. So Tosfos points out, Maseches Brachos, he says that what it means to wash out the cup is not some mystical thing, as some Kabbalists do take it that way, that you're supposed to wash it out anyway. It's not some mystical thing. It means that the cup is dirty, so you have to make sure that the cup is absolutely clean. So technically speaking, but most people, before they make Kiddush, if they take the cup right out of the cabinet and it's perfectly clean, so you don't wash it at all before you make Kiddush. But some people say that on Seder night, just to make extra, again, differences, so you wash it out anyway, even if it's totally clean. So some people have the minhag, other people don't. There's another thing about pouring the wine, which is a minhag that I dislike, which is that nobody pours for themselves, rather they have someone else pour for them in derech cheiros, because that's like free people have someone serving them. So first of all, the way this is brought in the Shulchan Aruch, I believe it's mentioned by the Ramah, he says that that's only for the Baal HaBayis. It's only for the person leading the Seder. It's not for everyone. How it got extended to everyone, everybody wants to be served, I don't know. So that's for sure. There's really nothing to be said for that minute. Again, there's nothing wrong if you want to do it, but that's not the way it was originally formulated. But I don't like this minhag at all. When I have my wine, I like to pour it. I like to put it to the level that I want. I don't want to spill. I just want to be benachas. I want to be relaxed. For me, it's more relaxing if I pour my own wine. Therefore, at my Seder, I do not have someone pour me the wine. I pour the wine for myself. My wife likes someone to pour for her, so that's what they do. But so other people do. So they do it backwards. The Baal HaBayis doesn't have someone pour for him, but everybody else does have someone pour for them. Whatever makes people happy. But I happen not to like this minhag. Also, some people say that the minhag doesn't apply nowadays at all. Because it's talking about a time when they used to mix the wine with water. So when they used to mix the wine with water, so it was very difficult to do it. Really, you had to have an expert sommelier servant to mix the wine for you. But nowadays, they're just pouring out of a bottle, and it's not an act of servitude at all, so this minhag is not necessary nowadays. We all know that during the year, there are different customs as to whether Kiddush is recited sitting or standing. In regular Friday night Kiddush, for example, some people stand the whole time. Some people stand for Vayechulu and sit down for the Kiddush. Some people sit the entire time. So as far as I'm aware, the general custom is that this custom is maintained on Seder night as well. That people, for example, it falls on Shabbos, so that people do half and half, stand for Vayechulu, sit down for the rest of Kiddush. People who always stand for the whole Kiddush on Shabbos Yom Tov stand on Seder night as well, and people who sit for the whole Kiddush sit on Seder night as well. But there are shitas, actually, interestingly enough, that say that if you normally stand for Kiddush, or you normally stand for Vayechulu, so you should sit dafka on Seder night, because it's more derecheros. It's more of a free person, like we can just relax, we can just sit the whole time. And there are poskim who say that everyone should sit on Seder night. But like I said, this recommendation is not generally followed, and everybody adheres to their regular custom on Seder night as well. There's another custom that we're really hitting home runs here that I don't like on Seder night, which is that normally, of course, what's done is that one person makes Kiddush on behalf of everyone at the table. And that's correct, al pi halacha, because there's a din in Maseches Bran and Maseches Brachos, which is Beravam Hadras Melech. That the more people are yotzei a mitzvah with one mitzvah act, are the better. It's considered a greater glory to God. So therefore, if everybody is yotzei at the table with one kiddush, that's a kiyum of Baravam Hadras Melech. But some people have the minhag on Seder night, even people who normally are makbid on Baravam Hadras Melech, that everybody recites the kiddush together. Some do one after the other, but that takes a ton of time, and you're in time crunch here, so it's not always recommended either. But everybody recites the Kiddush together. So I don't, I don't see why we should be mevater, why we should give up the concept of Rabam Hadras Melech on Seder night. Some people say because it's part of the four cups, so everybody says our own bracha on the four cups, but it has nothing to do with each other. You can say your own bracha on the rest of the cups and still be Yotzei Rabam Hadras Melech on the first cup. I don't like that concept, but again, halachically, you're Yotzei. There's no problem. So some people, since they bedavka, like to make their own kiddush on Seder night. So what I do at my Seder is I say, our minhag is that I'm going to say kiddush and be motzi everyone. If for some reason you're opposed to this or you really feel strongly about making your own kiddush, so please don't recite it along with me, because then that could create problems for people who are listening that they can't hear the kiddush of the Baal HaBayis clearly. So that's not recommended. Either everyone should say it together or just one person. It shouldn't be somewhere in between. So I say, so wait till after I'm done, then you can make your own kiddush. Most people don't take me up on it, but again, the offer is there. There's a difference between this is something that I wrote in my guide, which confused a lot of people, that I want to just take a minute now to explain, which is that there are different shitas about how big the cup is supposed to be. So, as you, I'm sure, know from my previous Aaron Bullman Memorial Lecture, so strictly speaking, I believe that the cup, the size of Rabbi Yis is quite small, even smaller than is normally practiced. It's actually 75 milliliters or so, which is about 2.6 ounces, so less than 3 ounces. So, technically speaking, I believe that's correct, but I wrote in my guide that ideally, for the first cup, since it's a d'oraisa type of thing, and the Mishnah Berurah recommends to be machmer for the Chazon Ish Yorim, quote-unquote, for d'oraisa, so use a larger cup for the, if you can, again, it's as a chumrah, whatever, if you can, as a respect to the Chazon Ish, whatever, to use, in the Mishnah Berurah, to use a larger cup for the first cup of the four cups. But I said, this only applies to a person who's actually reciting Kiddush, not to someone who's listening for Kiddush, because the d'oraisa of listening to Kiddush, you're yotzei by listening to someone else. The drinking of the cup as part of the four cups is for sure only derabanan, so you could for sure rely on the smaller shiur even for the first cup. So again, the person, the chumrah that I recommended in my guide to have the 150 milliliter cup for the first cup only applies to one who is actually reciting Kiddush and not to your listening, not to listening to Kiddush even though you're drinking a cup, which is basically considered a cup of Kiddush. Some people also make a mistake that they don't drink the wine fast enough. That's a problem. It's supposed to be drunk in a reasonable amount of time. Some say kedei achilas pras, which is a couple minutes, and some people say kedei shtias revias, the amount of time it takes to drink a revias, which is a very short amount of time. So some people take a tiny sip, they don't like wine, they leave it for several minutes, and then they try to take another tiny sip. And you see, you have glass cups, as many people do for the four cups. You can see, only this tiny amount is missing for the cup. They've been working on it for 6-7 minutes already. Like, what's going on over here? That's not proper. You have to try to drink the shear, which is at least the rov revius, the majority of revius, again, so 36 milliliters or so. Yeah, if you can drink a whole revius, that's better, but if you can drink, certainly a rov revius has to be drunk within the time of, within a reasonable amount of time. B'dievet, a couple minutes, b'lechatchila, you know, just a few seconds. And if you can't handle wine in that amount of time, so use grape juice. It's better to actually be yotzi the drinking of the cup, even if you have to use grape juice, even though in general grape juice is not as preferable as wine for the four cups. I remember at one of my starim, one of the years, so somebody was there, and we had this issue with somebody where I noticed after several minutes that only, you know, a tiny amount was missing from the cup. So I said, I'm the most lenient person you can imagine when it comes to shiurim, to the minimum sizes of the mitzvos. So you got to take my word for it that you really got to drink more. If I'm telling you need to drink more, you know it's absolutely required, and I'm not trying to be machmer on you over here. Urchatz. That's a verb, not a noun. So the washing of the hands of Urchatz, as many people know, is based on a halacha that's really applicable all year round, like I was talking about before, that liquids are more easily mekabel tuma than solids. So you have to wash your hands all year long, until tilas yadayim, if you eat something that's dipped in a liquid. That's certainly the case with karpas. However, there is a sheet of Tosfos that Tosfos says that it doesn't apply nowadays that there's no tumah and tahara at all. So technically speaking, you wouldn't have to wash for karpas at all. So based on that, or any time you eat something dipped in liquid. So assuming that's the case, the Shulchan Aruch has a compromise opinion. He paskins like most Rishonim that the Netilas Yadayim is absolutely required for something dipped in liquid, but he says we should be choshesh for toises to the extent that you shouldn't make a bracha. Remember, according to most Rishonim, you do make a bracha on washing for something dipped in liquid. So that's why everybody says you don't make a bracha on Urchatz. It's not because there's a special din by Urchatz, it's because in general we don't make a bracha when it comes to washing Netilas Yadayim. A lot of times people accidentally make a bracha by Urchatz. They're used to washing, and they make a bracha. So, and they kick themselves, oyvei, I committed such a terrible sin, I made a bracha on Urchatz. It says clearly in the Haggadah that you're not supposed to make a bracha on Netilas Yadayim for wet foods. So I say, Adarabba, once in your life, you fulfilled the opinion of most Rishonim that you have to wash with a bracha on something that's dipped in a liquid. So it's certainly not bracha levatol or anything if you accidentally make a bracha on Urchatz. I'm not saying to do it, but it's not the biggest problem, certainly. So based on this, you understand why some people have the minhag that only the Baal HaBayis, the leader of the Seder, washes for Urchatz. Because we really paskin, according to minhag Ashkenaz, we really paskin like Tosfos, that you don't have to wash at all for dipped liquids nowadays. But since you want to do something different, because it's Seder night and we try to do a lot of different things, so at least someone's going to wash to fulfill what it says in the song. Kadeh Yishurchatz, going to do the song. So somebody has to wash, even though most people are not washing. Rav Moshe Mordechai Karp, he has a new sefer on brachos. And he discusses all sorts of very interesting topics that are not usually discussed very much, including the rules for washing for wet foods. So he says that you could be makel when you wash for wet foods, not to wash twice. You don't wash for bread, you wash once and twice and once and twice. And according to most Rishonim, that's not even required for bread. So he says, for sure, for tibula b'mashke, for washing for wet foods, you only have to wash your hands once. If you want to wash twice, nothing wrong with that. But he says, technically speaking, you don't have to do that. For karpas itself, there's also a misunderstanding somewhat about karpas, which is that, what's karpas? The salad course, of course. The salad course. In ancient banquets, they used to begin with a salad course. So it's supposed to be a nice vegetable, raw vegetable, dipped in a dressing. So that's why I don't love the idea of using potatoes and things like that for karpas. So technically, according to the halacha, really, since you're just doing something different, so it just has to be anything where you make the bracha of bari pri ha'adama. Say that the Elizabeth the Rav used to use bananas for Karpas because he wanted to teach people that they're bar pri adama. So it's a very nice learning thing, but it's not really the spirit of Karpas. The spirit of Karpas is a raw green vegetable that you have a dressing. So what do you use for the dressing? So according to the Rambam, you actually use charoses, that you dip in charoses over here. But according to the other Rishonim, like whom we paskin, you don't use charoses over here, you just use literally something closer to dressing. They say either salt water or vinegar. So I assume in Europe that vinegar, wine vinegar, used to be, not grain vinegar obviously, but wine vinegar, whether you can use on Pesach, used to be expensive, so they couldn't afford it, so they use salt water. It's a cheap, very cheap salad dressing. So nowadays, Baruch Hashem, in America, the Jewish community is better off, so why should we use salt water?
Because we've done it for...
Exactly, okay. Because traditional, it's become traditional now to use salt water. But I like to use vinegar, balsamic vinegar, red wine vinegar, something like that, that you actually use for salad dressing for karpas, because it's tastier that way. It's supposed to be a nice, salad course. There is a problem also that you really should not be eating the karpas with a fork. Because since the whole takana of netilas yadayim for urchatz is that you're not supposed to touch wet foods. So really, you wash your hands because you're touching a wet food. So if you don't make a bracha, so it's not so bad. But if you accidentally make your bracha on urchatz, then you definitely should touch the touch the karpas, but you should touch it anyway. You're not supposed to eat it with your hand because that's why that's why you wash netilas yadayim before you eat the karpas. Yachatz. The Rambam says that you actually have yachatz not at this point in the Seder, but right before motzi matzah, meaning that you're trying to emphasize you don't have lechem mishnah on Seder night, but rather you rip one in half. That's the sheet of the Rambam, by the way, that you only use two matzahs. So if you only use two matzahs, so the ripping it in half is mafkia, undoes the halacha of lechem mishnah, you no longer have lechem mishnah. But according to our minag, which we don't have time to get into the whole reasons for right now, why that we have lechem mishnah plus the one you break in half, you have a total of three matzahs, so that's not the reason we do yachatz. The reason we do yachatz is to break the matzah right before magid. Why would you break the matzah right before magid? Because the Gemara says that one it has a drusha on lechem oni. So lechem oni means bread of affliction, right? So the Gemara darshins that another level of interpretation is that lechem she'onin olav dvarim harbe, that it's lechem upon which you recite many things, meaning the Haggadah has to be done over the matzahs. It has to be recited over the matzahs, the same way you recite brachos on a cup of wine. So the Haggadah is recited over the matzahs, meaning you have to hold them the whole time, but they have to be there on the table and uncovered the whole time that you're reciting the Haggadah. So there, you want to break the middle matzah so you have the real poor man's bread. You have both drushes of lechemoni. That you have the poor man's bread that you have half a matzah over here, that you don't even have a full matzah. And you're reciting the whole Haggadah over the broken matzah. That's why we perform yachatz right before the Magid section. Al pi Kabbalah, it says that you should try to break the matzah into one piece that resembles a dalet and one piece that resembles a vav. How on earth are you supposed to do that? The answer, of course, that they're talking about soft matzahs, that in the olden days when they used to bake fresh matzahs, hot matzahs for the Seder, and that were very nice and warm and fluffy, not so fluffy, they're very dense, but nice and warm and fresh, so you can use a knife and you can cut the matzah into whatever shape you want. You can make it a dalet and a vav. But in our matzahs nowadays, it's exceedingly difficult to make a dalet and a vav shape just by breaking it with your hands and hoping it cracks in the right place. Okay, magid. We should make sure to pour the second cup before the recitation of the four questions, because the four questions are the instigation of magid, and the magid is supposed to be recited over the second cup of wine. So you shouldn't miss out any of magid being recited over the second cup of wine, but you should pour it before manishtana. You do not, according to most poskim, you do not have to re-rinse out the cup between the first and second cup, and between the third and fourth cup. You only have to wash out the cup, like I mentioned, for kosher bracha, if it's not clean, for the first cup and the third cup, which is benching, which are the real kosher shel bracha, that are really associated with the reciting of a bracha over them. The other ones are also sort of kosher bracha, but they're not... We all apply every single normal din, that you apply to Kol Shabracha that has to be clean at the time that it's filled, but rather you can just fill it. There are some people who are very frum, and they actually wash out the cup in between all the four cups. I'm just reminded that I forgot to acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Hoffman, very honored to have here. So he keeps writing notes. So I'm reminded of the story that when Rav Soloveitchik, this is totally attention, but whatever. When Rav Soloveitchik came to America, he was giving a shiur in front of the Agudas Harabonim. And his father, Moshe Soloveitchik, told him that, don't worry, don't be nervous about giving the shiur. You know how to learn way better than all of them. There's just one person there that you have to look out for. So he says, okay, whatever. So he gave the shiur, and he sees that the whole time, there's one person, everyone's just like staring, you know, happily like that most of the time, except there's one person in the audience who's consistently every few minutes, he's jotting down some notes. So he's like, okay, whatever, he's taking notes, he wants to remember my shiur. So what is it? I'll tell you what it is in a second. He comes over to him after the shiur, presents him this piece of paper where he's writing his notes, and he sees it's a list of 10 difficult kashas on the shiur that he had no answer to. He slugged up the whole shiur with these notes. So who was that? It was Reb Lazer Silver of Cincinnati. It was Reb Lazer Silver was the one person in the Agudas Harabanim that the Rav had to watch out for. So I'm a little nervous that I'm going to get this piece of paper at the end of the shiur with all these kashas.
I don't walk around
on a top hat
either.
Yeah. Before Manishtana, the Gemara says that you take out the table, meaning the little table. So the Vilna Gaon says, so we should apply that to the Kaira as well. You take out the Seder plate right before Manishtana. What's the point? The children are supposed to say, Tati, where's the food going? We haven't eaten yet. You know, what's going on over here? And then the father says, oh, Avodim Hayunu L'Farah B'Masraim. You don't even need the four questions. He just says, what's going on? Why do we need these things? So, what?
It works. You did it when my kids were little.
Oh, yeah? Good, perfect. So not everybody has the practice to do this anymore nowadays because kids have wised up. They realize it's just a decorative plate that happens to have some food on it. You're not actually eating from it. So you don't, some people don't bother. They just put it, some Rishonim say that you put it on the edge of the table. You don't actually have to take it completely out of the room. But it's still a nice thing to do, I think, that just lift it up. Oh, now we're finished. We're finished with the Seder. We're finished you know, eating everything, so you try to take it out. It encourages the children to ask a question, as Rabbi Hoffman said, yes. Apparently, it actually does work. I don't think my son is going to get it yet, but eventually, it's a shame. Hopefully, it's gonna work. Technically speaking, the children are the ones who are supposed to say Manishtana. Not even every child needs to say Manishtana, although most would like a chance to. But technically speaking, if one person says Manishtana, that's enough for everyone, and then you can just continue with Avodim Hayinu. In fact, again, when you have this question, I think actually it did happen with an adult, that at the first Seder that I made here in Washington Heights, that somebody, and I took away the Seder plate, or started to take away the Seder plate, somebody said, why are you doing that? So I said, oh, Avodim Hayinu L'Farah B'Mitzrayim. Why are we asking the four questions? We don't need to. You just asked me what's going on over here. Why is this night different from all other nights? But that didn't fly. We will have to recite the four questions. So some people have the minhag that everybody recites the four questions afterwards, just to emphasize. There is a diuk in one girsa of the Rambam that so the leader of the Seder has to recite the four questions over after the child does, because the child can't be motzi you with manishtana. That's not the pashtus. The pashtus is that it's sufficient just for one child or all the children, whatever it is, to recite the four questions. A commonly overlooked law of the Seder that I know some of you have heard of, but others might not have, is that Magid should not be too long. You should try to make Magid as short as possible so that the children can hear all of Magid and will go to sleep. Well, not go to sleep, I'm sorry. Will not go to sleep till the end of Magid. And you should try to do it very quickly. You should not have all the children say all the vortlach that they learned in school right then and there. Why not? Because Magid is the mitzvah of Tzipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is not limited to those few pages of the Haggadah. You can continue to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim during the meal. Also, people are going to be starving a lot of times if they want to have their meal already. The point of the Seder is a festive meal with some discussion associated with it. It's not the discussion is supposed to totally eclipse the meal. That's not right either. So if you have a short Magid, feel free. You can continue discussing the Tzipur Yetzias Mitzrayim all night long if you want. In fact, Halacha says that you're supposed to stay up. You're supposed to continue discussing Tzipor Yetzias Mitzrayim until you fall asleep. You're not supposed to go to sleep on Seder night. You're supposed to continue discussing the Exodus until sleep overtakes you. So the Brisker Rav famously asked, "Oh, Rav Osai, there's a problem over here. On Shavuos, when there's no halacha to stay up all night long, it's only a custom of the Kabbalists in the 16th century. Everybody stays up all night. But on Pesach, when it's a din, a real halacha that you're supposed to stay up all night as much as possible, everybody, as soon as the Seder's over, they push in their chairs and go straight to sleep." So most of us are not in the position of learning right until Vasikin. But again, certainly all the vortlach, the nice extra things to say, I'm all in favor of peppering the discussion a little bit during Magid with extra things that are apart from the actual text of the Haggadah. Everybody can say they have an interesting comment or something that comes to mind right then and there. That's fantastic. That's great. But we should make a point of not schlepping it out too much. That's something, again, that's not the culture in many families, and many that makes darim, but and sometimes it's impossible to change. But for those who have some control over it, so it's worthwhile to keep in mind. Like I said, the matzahs are supposed to remain uncovered throughout the entire Magid, except when you raise the cup, because it's considered, again, the other reason for the challah cover is that when you're saying a bracha over wine, so it makes the challah feel bad, because the bread feels bad when it's not, there's a bracha being said, and it's not over the bread. So when you lift the cup, so you cover the matzahs, and when you have the cup down, when you're not actually holding it, so you're supposed to have the matzah specifically uncovered because of this halacha of lechem she'onin olav dvarim harbe, that the Haggadah is supposed to be recited over the uncovered matzahs. The way they used to do it in the times of the Gemara was that one person used to recite the Haggadah and everybody else used to be yotzi just by listening, the same manner of reciting Kiddush. I guess the Haggadah is so long nowadays that, or that people are less used to hearing it, so everybody normally recites it in undertone if one person's reading, or maybe you go around the room reading out loud, and you recite it in an undertone, but technically speaking, that's not required. I always tell people at my Seder, there's somebody else who's reading aloud, and the other people are just mumbling in an undertone, so whoever's reading aloud should have in mind to be motzi everyone else with the reading of the Haggadah, because in case you space out for a few seconds and you don't say the words in an undertone with the person who's reading aloud, you can at least be yotze by listening to someone else recite the Haggadah. Rabbi J.J. Schachter told us once that when he was the Rav of the Jewish Center on the West Side, there was an invention that he had never heard of before, but only discovered at that time. And that was the Seder spoon. Because on the West Side, all these fancy people, when you spill the wine from the cup, when you recite the 10 plagues, can't stick your finger into the wine. That's unelegant. So they had these little silver spoons that they would dip into the wine. They take one drop out after another at those times. So that's, again, it doesn't technically matter exactly how you take the wine out of the cup, although the Mishnah Berurah does say that you're supposed to use this finger because this is the finger is called the etzba. So it's to use this finger to take the because of Etzba Elokim Hi, that the plagues were the finger of God. So it's a remembrance of that. So you use this finger. So most people use the pinky finger. That was the custom. So apparently, I'm not 100% sure this is true, but somebody once went to the Chafetz Chaim after the Seder and said, "Rebbe, you wrote in the Mishnah Berurah that you're supposed to use your index finger to take the wine out of the cup. So why did you use your pinky to take the wine out of the cup?" So he said, "That's what my father did. He used the pinky." So in all his sukkim in the Mishnah Berurah, weren't necessarily supposed to undermine people who had a strong traditional practice. But in any event, that's what he does say. So if you don't have another traditional practice, so use this finger to take the wine out of the cup. Reb Chaim Brisker, the Rav's grandfather, it's only Washington Heights or for YU people, you have to introduce Reb Chaim Brisker as the Rav's grandfather. Normally he's the standard. The Rav is Reb Chaim Brisker's grandson. Whatever. So apparently, he did not spill any of the wine from the cup when he recited the 10 plagues. They said the cup that you recite the Haggadah over is sort of like a kosher bracha. I mean, it's a sort of kosher bracha. So you start playing around with the kosher bracha. You start spilling from it. In the middle of Kiddush, you would start taking some wine out of the cup. You should treat the whole Magid as if you're reciting the Haggadah over an official formal cup of wine so you don't spill. So that was the shita. But in traditional Judaism, they weren't concerned about this. And you certainly did spill the wine out of the cup when you recite the 10 plagues so as to diminish your simcha. One thing that you do have to keep in mind, even if you're not like Reb Chaim Brisker and you do spill the wine out of the cup, as most people do, It's a very ancient custom, not ancient, but a very old custom. It's several hundred years old.
It's a very powerful symbol.
Yeah, but he didn't care about powerful symbols. He cared about his interpretation of the halacha. That was it. Fine. So, but if you do take some drops of wine out of the cup and you got a little more than you thought you would, and now the cup is no longer full, so you do have to refill the cup after the 10 plagues, because one of the halachas of a kosher bracha is that it has to be full. It shouldn't be visibly empty. It doesn't necessarily have to be overflowing, according to most opinions, but it does have to be. So if you would look at the cup and you say, oh, yes, that's a full cup. That's one thing certainly to keep in mind. There's a little bit of an odd custom that normally when you recite Hallel, you stand, right? Mm-hmm. On Seder night, you sit when you recite the Hallel, which begins at the end of Magid. So this is sort of the same idea as like we're talking about before with the Kiddush, that's something that you normally stand for. So on Seder night, there might be more of a reason to sit for it because it's more derech eros, it's more relaxed, it's more like you're a free person at this point in time. But some Hasidim actually have the minhag that they stand for the Hallel on Seder night. Even though they're around the table as part of the Seder, nevertheless, they stand for it. But that's not certainly the simple understanding of the halacha, which is adhered to by the vast majority of Jews in the world, is that you sit for Hallel even on Seder night. Rav Schechter said once in Shir that his father-in-law was a shtickl chassidish. He was a reshiva in Torah Vadas, which has a little chassidish flair to it, maybe not so much anymore. But Rav Schechter, when he first went to Seder by his father-in-law, he stood for the Hallel on Seder night. What is going on over here? Who on earth heard of this thing of standing for Seder night? But even though he held not that way, you got to do what the Shver does. You don't make issues with him publicly, in general. For motzi matzah, for the eating of the matzah on Seder night, so one thing that's important to keep in mind is that all the matzah that you eat on Seder night is in fulfillment of a mitzvah. As the Netziv had a careful reading of the Rambam, and so it's a simple understanding of the earlier sources as well, that it says that once you eat a kezias of matzah, you're yotzei the mitzvah. That you fulfill the mitzvah once you eat an olive's size bulk of matzah. But it means mitzvah is to eat matzah on Seder night. There's no limit. You eat matzah. So all the matzah that you eat on Seder night is in fulfillment of the mitzvah. That's why one should not limit oneself to the minimum amount. And that's why, as I was discussing earlier this morning, even though, again, Meikradin, I think that the kezias is very tiny, it's the size of an olive. Nevertheless, I recommend, based on what I learned from Rabbi Willig, that since there are opinions, many opinions in the Rishonim, that maybe because they never saw olives, whatever it is, they did say that an olive is half the size of an egg, which it obviously isn't. But since they said it out of respect to those opinions, so you try for a motzi matzah to eat half the size of an egg. You don't have to go with a gigantic shiurim, the doubling of the half the size of an egg, to eat the size of a whole egg. That not. But they should try to eat half the size of an egg. For a healthy person, if you can't eat that much, so you eat the size of an olive. But you should eat way more than half an egg during the course of Seder night. I mean, again, it has to be in the minimum time frame. It has to be in Kedei Achilas Pras, which is just a couple of minutes. Not exactly clear. The Chazal didn't have minutes, so they didn't tell us exactly how many minutes long it was. But you should try to eat it as quickly as possible. And even if you're eating a bigger shear than the minimum olive's bulk, even though some poskim say that ideally you're supposed to eat it in one gulp, literally, that the whole shear of Kedei Achilas Pras, giving it a minimum time span, is only b'dieved. That's not ideal. That's not ideal. And really, you should eat it in one fell swoop. So that only applies to the real olive size piece. That, you I think, would be pretty easy to swallow in one fell swoop. But if you want to eat more than that, so you take advantage of the minimum time frame. And there's certainly a lot more to discuss, but I think we're going to stop here. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them now. Have a Chag Kosher V'Sameach.